Happy to welcome in, as we always are whenever he's here, Toronto Mayor John Tory. Hello, sir.
Hello, Deb and Jay. How are you doing?
Doing very well, thank you.
Good.
So, Mayor, we heard from the city today that there's going to be a significant shift in how we're administering vaccines to that last group of folks who either only have one or don't have any vaccines. Can you tell us a little bit about that? I think it's starting sort of later August.
Yes, it starts on the 22nd of August, and we're going to reduce from 9 to 5 the number of mass vaccination clinics we have. And I think it's simply human nature that's responsible for this, in that, you know, in the early going, up until now, it's easier to get people to come to us to get their vaccination, those who aren't hesitant, those who actually were, you know, looking forward to having it done with enthusiasm, first and second dose. But now we're into a stage where we have people with more reasons to be hesitant, or with more reasons to have obstructions in front of them, or different things. And so we're going to take the same resources, as we saw the number of people coming out to the clinics declining, and redeploy those resources, the nurses and the other staff, to clinics that are in people's neighborhoods, you know, building by building, neighborhood by neighborhood, and be able to target better the neighborhoods that have under vaccination. So, for example, this weekend in the Taylor Massey neighborhood, which is kind of in the East End around Victoria Park and Danforth, we will have 9 clinics outside or inside grocery stores that we know the neighbors frequent, and doctors from the locality will call the people in that area to tell them these clinics are going on, and that's just going to work better to get them out than if we left a clinic open, you know, somewhere nearby. So that's why we're making the shift. It's in the interest of just keeping those numbers moving up. We're doing well, 80% first dose, 75% second dose, but we need to keep moving.
So no doubt this sort of hyper-local approach, the new strategy, will help with those folks who have been unable to, or where there's a language barrier, or there's some other barrier to get their vaccine. But what about, have you been given any advice on how big the number is of folks who just, it's not an access issue, who just are going to refuse to get the vaccine?
Yeah, there have been a number of surveys taken, not so much by us, but by lots of other people, and they sort of say it's somewhere in that kind of 10% neighborhood of people who, for a variety of reasons, just refuse. So we'll work away at everybody else. 10% is 10%. But we've got to keep pushing the numbers up because it's our best defense against the Delta variant. And it's interesting, in that Taylor Massey neighborhood, we had our ambassadors that we're out using to convince people to get vaccinated, and they're going door-to-door, and they were talking to people door-to-door about why they hadn't been vaccinated or why they hadn't got their second shot. And some of them name hesitancy to do with some of these rumors that are out there about different things about the vaccines. Many others just say, well, look, it hasn't worked out well for me in terms of being able to take time off work to do it. They have, you know, reasons like that. And so we think they're, you know, to be candid, there's maybe been a bit of a Pfizer factor here, where people saw that at one time we had a very low supply of Pfizer, so they were getting Moderna, and we actually had, you know, 10% of people refusing to have a vaccination once they found out it was going to be Moderna. So now Pfizer's in better supply, so that's going to help. But there's a whole bunch of factors that explain the remainder of the people between 10%. For example, there are 350,000 people in the city right now who've had their first dose but have not had their second dose. And some of them, when we ask them, well, why not, they say, well, I have an appointment made into September and I didn't know I could come earlier. So, you know, we're now telling them they can come earlier. But these are the kinds of things we're dealing with, and it's a very complicated thing, and it's human nature involved a lot, but we're working very hard at it.
This is from 7-10-10. I know it's provincial, but I'm sure they'd still love to hear your thoughts. I'm curious what the mayor thinks about Ontario soon to be regularly reporting how many COVID-19 cases are in unvaccinated people.
Oh, it's a necessity, because I think it really will be a powerful factor in convincing people to get vaccinated, because the fact is that I think I'm right in saying about 90% of the cases that are still being reported are people who are unvaccinated. And so, you know, it really proves the point that if you get vaccinated, you're highly unlikely to get COVID-19 or the Delta variant. So I think it's good that Ontario is going to do it. Other places are doing it, and I think they're trying to make the same point. You know, you are highly unlikely to get this virus or any variant on it if you get vaccinated.
So, Mayor, July 14th, Toronto City Council decided that Dundas Street and some other civic assets would be renamed in an effort to promote inclusion and reconciliation with marginalized communities. That process is kicking off. We hear today that there's a petition that started that's already got over 300 people on it, calling for Dundas Street to be renamed after your predecessor, Mayor Rob Ford. Is this something that will go to council ultimately? Is this something that you as mayor will have a say in, or is this something that the process itself will determine? And do you have a thought on this?
Well, we, Look, I think at some point there should be some recognition of Rob Ford's service, and I brought something forward to City Council before, which didn't get through. But having said all that, the Dundas thing is not the place to be doing that necessarily, and it's not going to be up to me anymore. What we're going to try to do is take the politics out of this whole naming business, and also try to avoid situations that create the kind of difficulty we're now experiencing with the Dundas name. And so part of what's coming back from the city manager's office, the public servants, in the spring, is both a process to decide on how you would rename Dundas Street itself so that you'd actually have some thing that will involve public consultation, but also a longer-term process to determine how you determine who gets recognized and who doesn't, and frankly, when there are these movements saying we should take the name off something, how you decide that, because that shouldn't be left to politicians. I mean, it gets too political, if you'll pardon the expression, and I just think there needs to be a process to deal with these things in an orderly, thoughtful way, both the naming of something and the denaming of something, if I can call it that. So there are petitions out there for other people whose names should be used on Dundas Street, and I think that can all go into some process that will be revealed in the later part of this year, early next, and we'll see what people decide. It ultimately will be approved by council, but I'm sure it's on recommendation of some objective people who can, you know, do this outside political considerations.
So certainly this is a program that I think, you know, when we looked at it as maybe Winterlicious or Summerlicious, it got massive response. I know it's something my wife and I look forward to every year. We have a revamped program called Dine Together.
Yeah, it's going to be, it's the same kind of thing. It's a sort of, I'll call it a prefix dinner where you get an entree and either dessert or an appetizer for a fixed price. And the fixed prices go from, I think, $15 up to $45 and with $5 increments. So it could be $15, $20, $25, $30. And the restaurants offer that as kind of a special offer for this period between mid-September and early October. And the registration for it starts in about a week. Details to be found at toronto.ca. And it's very much like, for those who have experienced Winterlicious or Summerlicious, the same thing, except we've taken down even the tiniest barriers that existed, like in terms of fees that people had to pay to be part of it, meaning the restaurants, and because we're really trying to help the restaurant industry here, and I think this will be a big hit. I think it'll be going at a time when our entire Show Love TO program is on, which will have lots of stuff like this, and shop local initiatives, and artists performing on the main streets in different neighborhoods, and I hope to add a lot more. I'm still hopeful we could do a fireworks demonstration, because we've postponed a couple of those from Victoria Day and Canada Day, so I'm still hopeful we can do that. And really just have people, assuming the numbers cooperate, have a bit of a sense that the city's coming back to life and that life is returning more to normal.
Almost to the person, when we spoke with restaurant owners throughout all of this, I've found the resilience and their attitudes to be frankly amazing despite what they're going through. Is that attitude prevalent right now? Or are people excited to get opened?
I think so. You know, like, people forget that for all the hoopla about patios, which was great when it happened, 85% of restaurants in Toronto don't have patios. So they, you know, weren't as interested in whether the patios open or not, but of course they got a couple of weeks ago the opening of indoor dining, and I think thanks to, you know, their resilience and persistence, and thanks to the government programs, I mean, I think they all acknowledge that the rent relief and the wage subsidy programs help them just hang on by their fingernails, and now I just hope that they get a good run over the summer of good weather, and that things like this Dine Together program work well to generate traffic for them, and I hope people, I'm sure they're doing it because they did it with takeout, I hope they're supporting these local restaurants, because it's going to take them quite a long time to make up for what they lost.
So, Mayor, there's been a story that's caught a lot of interest over the course of today, and it's about a 250-year-old tree and an opportunity for the city to build a parquet on what is now currently a private homeowner's property. And there's been a battle, I think, going on the last few months at least with this homeowner in the city who says, even though I struck a deal with the city in December of 2019, I'd like to redo that deal because my house is now worth, he thinks, $900,000 instead of $780,000. Is this something you've been involved with?
Well, I've been involved all the way through, and it was a great initiative where we said what we would do is supplement community fundraising, which, by the way, raised $400,000 so we could save this extraordinary tree, and I've been to see it. It is extraordinary. It's the biggest tree I think I've ever seen. But so we did this deal, and I can't really comment now on what's going on because it's in front of the courts, but I will just say we did a deal, and I'll say, unrelated to this matter, there's lots of people, I guess, who end up selling their houses and wish they could do it over again, but having said that, the courts will figure this out, and I'm just optimistic and hopeful this tree can be saved. We've got the $400,000 raised from the community, and the city said it would make up the difference to buy the house and turn it into a parkette and save the tree. So that's what we're still focused on doing, and the courts will help us to deal with that or not. I mean, depending on what they decide.
Toronto Mayor John Tory, as always, thank you for your time.
Thanks. Good to talk to you both.
The mayor joins us Friday at 5:35.